Reach across the stars. It's Toby Haydock's Who's Round. It won't be easy. Yeah, it will. Another fine actor has foolishly invited me into his house, so I'm going to ask him to tell me who he is and why I'm talking to him about Doctor Who.
Hello, my name is Trevor Cooper, and I've done two Doctor Who's. So I'm one of the few people who've done who's been last century, this century. I think there's about 20 or 30 of us, something like that.
According to IMDb, at the last look, it was 37.
37, I was growing. That's not bad. So, well, I mean, it must be growing all the time. But no, I did my first one, I believe it's 85, 86, something like that. The Revelation of the Daleks. And then I did one last year. I was in Robot of Sherwood, which is Peter Capaldi's, obviously, first series. It was about our third episode of the series, something like that. So that's my Doctor Who connection. Oddly enough, I was seen for the part that Roger Ashton Griffith played, Quail, who's the sort of father of the, you know, what turns out to be Maid Marian. Not the father, the ward of Maid Marian, that's right. He gets killed in the opening scene. There was scene for that. And then suddenly I got this thing through saying, oh, you've got the Doctor Who. And I went in assuming I was doing that. And I said, why have they booked me for a week? It's a scene. And they said, no, you'd have played Fry Tuck. The only time I played Fry Tuck before was for an advert for British pork.
Oh, really?
Years ago, we all got loads of roast pork as free gifts. There was a time when I did Ivanhoe on television.
And you were Girth.
I was Girth the Swineherd. But again, I originally auditioned for Fry Tuck, which Ron Donaghy eventually played. This happened quite a lot. I auditioned for one thing. I go, no, let's give him that. In actual fact, Girth was a much nicer part than Fry Tuck in that, because Girth went all the way through it.
Yeah, wonderful. Died in the last episode.
In the last episode. I got killed, yeah, that's right. And my dog slept on my grave and all that. A sort of big lurcher that had to be trained to keep still and lie on my grave. Yeah, no, it was, yeah.
So Tuck was like, but it's interesting about Doctor Who, though, because you're saying, because I remember being quite surprised that Roger Ashton Griffiths, who is no slouch, is in one scene, and when it said Trevor Cooper's going to be Fry Tuck, I thought, well, that's, because obviously I know you work from so many things, but you get good actors in not massive parts in Doctor Who.
Oh, sure.
You know?
I mean, I would have done the part that Roger played, you know, had I been offered it. I mean, it of course. I mean, partly, let's be honest, there is a financial thing too. You get repeats, you get the stuff, you get recognition, you get to go to conferences for conventions and things, even if you played something small. Oh, he's good.
And had you worked with Capaldi before?
No, I hadn't. I'm trying to even think whether we met. I don't think we had. I mean, I think we worked out we had some people in common. But I do think he's an absolutely terrific doctor. I mean, right from the read-through. And he's also a wonderful cast leader. He does that thing of welcoming everybody very specifically. Hello, and meeting them. And not, just, you know, he is what's wonderful about... I mean, yeah, Colin Baker was too. I mean, back in, you know, but Peter's got that thing. And I think he goes back to the, almost like the old school doctor. I think, you know, and more. He's got that. He's very funny, and he's got that arrogance. But at the same time, it's tempered with a sort of, you know, that he can, when he gets made a fool of, which he does do, he can ride that as well. You know, and I think he's a wonderful. I think he will be seen in years to come as the best.
That's the best.
I really do. I absolutely do. I mean, I think everyone in Doctor Who has, you know, their favourite is the one they started with. And, you know, I started with Hartnell, you know. And, this is my story. Doctor Who was that in 1963, Friday, the day before the first Doctor Who went out, I came out of Scouts and my dad was waiting for me in the car, which was unusual. Usually I used to walk 2 or 3 miles home. It was in North Devon where I grew up. And my dad said, I said, what are you doing here? He said, well, I thought I'd come and pick you up. He said, because something rather large has happened. I said, what? Thinking, he said, Kennedy's been shot. And I said, oh, God, really? He went, yeah. I went, well, what? You know, and we talked about it. And he drove me home. And he just sort of had this thing about Kennedy's been shot. I should look after my children. I mean, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That weird thing. But I remember the whole thing was I got back and there was no television. Television was sort of banned as a matter of respect. There was, you know, there was Potter's Wheel played endlessly for hours on end. There wasn't any, I think there may have been the odd news programme, but basically there was no television that night as a sort of respect. It was, well, I'll see that happening now.
Yeah.
And I was pissed off because I was thinking, I know this thing I've been really looking forward to was on tomorrow. And there was talk about, oh, is it going to be on? Because there was a big, I remember when Mark wrote, you know, Adventures of Space and Time, there was a whole thing about when Kennedy got shot, do they pull Doctor Who? And they didn't. In the end, it went ahead. And it, at that time, when I was 10, it was my favourite programme. My absolute favourite programme. And, you know, we, you know, Dad would say, oh, we're going around Granny's. No, I'm not. It's Doctor Who's on. She's not got telly. No, I'm not. I'm watching this, you know. And, you know, I remember, I still have this thing of the first moment they came out of that laboratory and on wherever it was. Was it, it wasn't Skara, it wasn't the planet, when they first met the Dalek.
Yeah, it was Skara.
It was Skara, yeah. Okay. And they come out of a laboratory and there. The, I still remember that. Still remember that story, the one they filmed, they made a feature film of.
Didn't yeah,
they? That was the, right. The one Peter Cushing. And, you know, so, you know, and then eventually when you get to be in one and you walk into the studio at the broadcasting house and there are four Daleks lined up. Because we'd been rehearsing with the guys who'd sit in the bottom half of a Dalek and sort of waggle their fingers like they had, you know, those whatever it was they had. And suddenly you walk into a studio and there are four Daleks. And it's like a sort of closure. Do you know what I mean? Because I got to blow one up as well in that. And it was like a sort of, that's my childhood. You know what I mean? That's a sort of, it was quite important. And then you sort of look a bit closely and they were all a bit, cardboard and egg boxes and made by the Blue Peter team, you know, I mean, they're not, they weren't high tech, they are now. You see them now and they're amazing, you know, but my friend Barnaby Edwards, who I do, I've done a lot of Big Finish stuff, and he operates them and they're now quite subtle. Then it was literally, there was a little, they were on wheels, they were on little casters and there was a bench seat and a guy would sit on it and he'd do that to make them move along, and there were four guys inside them. You know, and they only had four, because there's that story I told on the DVD about, you know, you have to be surrounded by Daleks. They didn't have enough, so they had two floor managers holding those eyepieces and things over my shoulder. So like, I had to turn around, and you could see, so it looked like I was surrounded. And
that's a great Graham Harper shot, that though, isn't it?
It is. And Graham had said, he said, Trevor, you turn around, look virtually into camera, and there's this, you know, you would imagine there's a Dalek, and it's a complete brown trouser job. So I did that, and Royce Mills, who was then the voice of the Daleks, they cut, suddenly his voice comes, and Royce Mills, why have your trousers gone brown?
So do you remember how you got to be in it the first time round?
It was, yeah, I can't remember whether Graham had seen me in anything, but I remember going to meet him for it, and as I was sitting outside, Pat Roach walked out of the interview room, who, you know, from the same Pat, the ex-wrestler, yeah, no longer with us, and I thought, there's always that thing, oh, I bet he's up for the same part, and he'll have got that then, you know, and so I went and met Graham, and I'd never met Graham before, and didn't know, had sort of hadn't really followed Doctor Who so much, I mean, I was that much older, so I didn't watch, you know, so I didn't know of sort of Graham's place within the whole Doctor Who pantheon. In fact, was that the first one he did?
Second
one he did, right. And, you know, but and we just got on. It was just one of those things where we sort of clicked. And he afterwards, you know, I said, you know, when I saw Pat, he said, no, he said, absolutely. I said, there was pressure on me to put someone who had more of an air, but no, he said, you and Colin, because Colin Spall was an old friend of his, they'd both been child actors together, and I still see Colin still does the conventions.
I see
very
Colin
much
a lot, yeah, yeah,
he does all the conventions, in fact we're doing one in October, I think, yeah, in Newcastle, I think.
And you're now, because you're a very interesting double act, it's a story full of double acts,
yes.
Revelation of the Dalek,
that's right,
and Tarkus and Lilt, you're quite a one with the flowers. Are you trying to suggest a subtext there?
There was no doubt about the fact that there was a slight sort of camp thing going on there. You know, I don't think Graham, ever wanted to get into it totally, but he wanted there to be a suggestion. His main thing was Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah.
His main thing was he wanted that. So what that came from was not from the fact that they were necessarily a gay couple, but that Tarkus was a bit Oliver Hardy. So that whole thing, you know, so there's a little bit of that in it. More than the, although, you know, we let, if people knew about that, we'd let it, right? Yeah, sure. That was the subtext and maybe, you know, and all that. So anyway, I think we're about the only people in the episode other than the regulars who survive.
It's a bloodbath.
Virtually everyone gets killed.
And quite horribly, quite graphically.
Some people talk about the whole thing where the lovely late departed Steve Flynn, who was an old friend from before, who he and Bridget Lynch Bloss, who I hadn't seen since we made that, and then I did a thing for Phantom Films last year in Bristol, and she was there. They were doing a special thing on Revelation, and it was me, her, and John Ogwin, that's right, yeah. And again, neither of whom I'd seen, and they asked us. We did a thing on Revelation, and that scene when they meet, they break into the lab, and there's that sort of white Dalek that sort of flies up in the air, and it's like people say it's the most terrifying scene in Doctor Who, you know.
Well, and the scene where you interrogate, one, there's the implication that he's an alcoholic, which is quite grown up for a Saturday teacher. Colin decides to mark her face with a flick knife.
That's
right. I mean, I don't think you'd be allowed to do that.
No, you certainly wouldn't. No, that's right. I'd forgotten there was all that sort of... There was a lot of sort of implicit violence in it. The other thing I do remember also was we did a read-through, and they hadn't got on the Dalek voices, you know, it was Roy, who did Rainbow.
Yeah, Roy Skelton.
Roy Skelton and Royce Mills were sitting at the end of the table. And I'd met Royce on something before. I said, are you, he said, oh no, he said, we're Dalek voices, is Roy Skelton. I said, aren't you Rainbow? He said, aren't you, you know, Rainbow? Yes, also a Dalek, you know. And anyway, so we were sort of, when it came to, you know, we obey, suddenly there where they'd be at the end of the table doing their stuff. And at the end, I remember them, Royce asking a question. He said, one of the things, Graham, one thing he said, in this episode, we don't get to say exterminate in this story. And it is sort of a thing that the Daleks do. And, you know, I wonder whether the fans might not miss it if we don't do it. And Graham said, actually, you know what? He said, I, it can become a bit of a cliche. So I'm sort of, I'd be quite happy not to have it. And Royce, fine, no, it's fine, you know, fine, no problem. We won't do exterminate then. You know, and anyway, so there's a point in rehearsals where somebody pushes someone over and runs away, and you know the Daleks are, and Roy said, well, you know, Graham was saying, well, maybe we should get the Daleks to say something at this point. What would they say? And Roy said, well, we could say exterminate, and Graham was like. Go on then. Exterminate! It was one of them. But you know, I always remember that. And also Alexei Sayle.
Yeah.
Being in it, and Eleanor Bron. An extraordinary cast. And I remember talking to Alexei about it, and Alexei sort of. He was great fun, but he said, this whole sci fi thing, he said, I just don't get it at all. He wasn't sort of interested in that whole thing. I do remember him talking about that and going like... And the other thing I remember was that we did a run-through. There were masses. Colin and what's the first?
Nicola.
There were a lot of gags. Masses of gags. And a lot of them quite naughty gags. Sort of, you know, very inner-looking, very sort of... that they'd sort of stuck in the little references and this, that, and the other, and Graham loved them, you know, and they were all in there. And we did a run for John Nathan Turner, and John Nathan Turner came in and said, "No, you got to cut all those. Can't have all that. It's a serious story." And fair enough, you know. So a lot of the sort of funny, there was a lot more funny stuff in it, a lot more slightly wacky. They had that running gag with Nicola running around that same. They always had the same stretch of corridors that they used to redress according to what planet they were on. And she'd always have a point when she'd stop and look around and go, all these corridors look the same! You know, and it within about three or four episodes. And Colin Baker was responsible for putting a lot of those gags in. You know, he was a great one for finding them, and sometimes they'd slip through and sometimes they wouldn't, you know. But it was, I just remember, it was great fun. Great fun.
Well, we might come back to Doctor Who at the end, but let's go right back to the beginning and what got you to that point. What, because your background initially wasn't in acting at all, was it?
No, I studied law. I grew up in North Devon and did A-levels and all that sort of thing, and then had to redo them. I didn't do terribly well. Wanted to do law and did law at Kingston Poly. And it just so happened that at Kingston Poly, for some reason, every year the law department did the pantomime. And so I got involved in the pantomime, and that was what got me going. I think I'd always, in the back of my mind, knew I wanted to sort of perform. You know, I was always someone at school who did impressions of people and did that, you know. But at school there was no drama or anything like that where I'd been. And at Kingston, I got involved in the Law Society pantomime every year. And the first year, I think I pulled the curtains. And the second year, I sort of did the music. I arranged the music and got a band together. And the third year, I wrote it. I wrote this pantomime and sort of played a compere sort of character and did a lot of stuff on track. It was a very rude pantomime with lots of bad jokes about sociologists who were the big rivals of some lawyers and the sociologists. And as a result of that, there was a guy, Rod Goodman, who was a lecturer there who ran the Drama Society, who said, would you be interested in we're doing Threepenny Opera? And I said, well, I knew nothing about it. I said, well, I can't sing opera. He said, well, it's not opera in that sense. It's you know, it's a piece. And I said, oh, I don't know. He said, well, we've got an exchange deal. We're going to Paris with it. And I said, well, yeah, that might be fun. And so I walked into this sort of audition, and they said, oh, this is Trevor, who's going to be playing Macheath in the Threepenny Opera. And I said, what's that? Is that a good part? I said, well, yeah, it's the lead. All right. So, you know, and I did, so we did this, and he cast a lot of mates in it, a lot of people who knew each other, some of whom I'm still in contact with. There was my then girlfriend was in it as one of the whores, you know, was in it. And we had this fantastic time doing this piece, and we went to Paris with it. And I remember one time in rehearsals, we were in the lecture theatre, and I had this absolute moment where I thought, there are people who do this for a living. And I, you know, I was doing the law. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I nearly dropped out after the first term because I knew I didn't want to be a lawyer. And part of me thought, well, maybe I'll sort of, you know, fight against the system, become a sort of civil rights sort of person. But I thought, no, that's really not me. I mean, yes, I'm, you know, of the left and have always been like that. But you have a weird situation when you're studying law that most of the students are quite conservative, whereas most of the staff are not, because they're all people who dropped out of the actual legal system. You know, so you'd have this sort of, and I was more in, there were only about three or four people on my course who were big friends, because most of them, you know, were all going to become solicitors in Dad's firm, you know, when they went. But I soon realised that, you know, that I wasn't going to be a lawyer, and that the acting bug started there, and I knew I had to give myself a chance. So I went on and did a master's in law at Warwick, where I met Alex Jennings and people like that who were all in that, and carried on doing plays, just did plays all the time then. Then decided, having done all that, got my master's, that I had to give myself a chance, and at 25 went to drama school. Round the corner, the drama studio in Ealing, which was a one-year course. And, you know, I got all the things from my dad and my mum saying, you're giving up, this is a waste of a good mind and all that. I had to explain to my mum, I said, it really isn't. It's, you know what I mean? It's a different way of thinking. It's not a waste of a good mind. And, you know, there is this whole thing about law where you have to be logical and think in a certain way. And that was never going to be for me. It really wasn't. And so I went to the drama studio, as I say, and it was one of those places where the average age was, about the average age. I mean, they didn't take 18-year-olds, as a matter of course, because it was a one-year course. They wanted people who'd done a degree, who were experienced a little bit in life. And I, you know, loved it. And, you know, I did all these things that, you know, I've never done since, and you're allowed to fail, and was cast in things that you wouldn't get cast in because they make you do that at drama school. And what happened was they had this thing called the Carlton Hobbs Award, which is the radio drama thing. And I think it was the first year it was called that. It had been called the Radio Drama Award. Carlton Hobbs had died recently, who'd been, you know, this great sort of radio actor, and they decided to call it the Carlton Hobbs Award. And we had this wonderful radio coach called Gordon Gardner, who's long since dead, but Gordon, amongst other things, used to work a lot with John Dexter, people like that. And Gordon came in and coached us. And there were three men, three women. We got to the final. We all were entered into this sort of final. And we swept up in the men's section. We were first, second, and third. And he was a fantastic radio coach. And so I knew what my first job was going to be. It was on the radio rep. And I also got a card, which in those days was, you know, crucial. So I didn't have to go off in rep to earn my card. I knew that when I left the drama school in July, that in October or September or something, I started on the radio rep, you know, with a card, with a job. And of course, you know, 6 months on the radio rep, everyone does radio. Mm. You know, everyone does, you know, and so, you know, we do like Trawlers and Cressida with all of the then RSC, and I'd be playing lots of bits around the edges. But you got to see these people at work, you know. And it was a fantastic sort of grounding. And it was also in the days on the radio rep when there were 30 people on the radio rep. Now there's about... It went down to, like, tiny. But it's now built up again because they have the Norman Beaton people. There's about a dozen, I think, now. Something like that. But it was a fantastic first job. And great fun and very civilised. You know, radio is, because you wear your own clothes and you turn up at 10 and, you know, you do all that. And so that was it. And, I mean, I got an agent out of that. And that's sort of when it started, you know, through that. Radio.
And so once you'd done the radio, was it then, I mean, did you have ambition to go into a particular area, or was it just at that point, just work?
I think it was just whatever. I mean, I think, you know, I've always, movies are my big love, and I haven't done very many movies. I don't go to the theatre that much, but I go to movies all the time. And I've been a member of BAFTA for about 15 years now, and I go to everything. I mean, literally, I go to the movies. You know, when it's the season is just starting, when they start doing these screenings of movies that have just come out, which won't actually be released for 3 or 4 months yet, you know. And I saw Everest the other night, which I think is released this week probably. And that's my big thing. And I think I'd love to have ended up as a, you know, movie actor, and I've probably done, you know, 7 or 8 movies. I've hardly done movies. It's been telly. But having said that, just work is, you know, they're so different, telly and you know, telly and film on one hand and theatre on the other, that I love doing both. I just find that theatre is difficult to earn a living at, that's all.
Cool.
And I've done a lot of theatre, an awful lot of theatre. I went for a stage quite recently where I was only doing theatre, and I thought, oh, this has got to stop, so I haven't now done theatre for nearly 2 years. That's a conscious decision. It means you're hanging around a lot more and waiting for, you know, because when you do get TV work, it may only be like, you know, a day here and a day there.
But the logic being, you don't want to be stuck in a theatre run and then miss out on a telly that might come.
That's right. The overall arc of things in terms of my career, such as it is that I never stopped when I started. I've been an actor 36 years, and for the first certainly 20 to 25, I never stopped. It's harder. It's just, and that's to do with, you know, one's age and the fact that, you know, in the end, particularly in television, they want things are aimed at younger people, and they want younger people, and you find that the older actors, you know, they use a much smaller pool than they used to, and it's the same people. So what you've done in the past doesn't count for a lot now. And I can, you know, fortunately, I've made enough contacts in the business so that I've done an awful lot, for example, for Andy Hamilton. We talked about Drop Dead Donkey, but, you know, I did things like Who Dares Wins and Chelmsford 1-2-3. Yeah. On Friday, I'm doing a play. Andy's written a play, a stage play, which is a bit like Chelmsford 1-2-3. It's a sort of Romans in Britain comedy. And we're just having a read. He wants to have a read of it. People he knows who can read, you know, and he just wants to sort of, you got an office and we're popping around in the morning, we're going to read this play. And, you know, so earlier this year, out of the blue, suddenly, you know, Ballot Monkeys came along.
Yes.
You know, which was a huge, lovely thing to do out of nowhere. And what's really nice about that, it sort of reminded a lot of people in television that I'm still alive. You know what I mean? And I got as much coverage of that, from that, as anything I've ever done. Because not only was one in every episode, Channel 4 really trailed it, and I was in the trailer. And so 10 times a day, there'd be my ugly mug on Channel 4, sort of, you know, and it just suddenly, people were around, oh, you're Trevor, are you, you know, all this, you know, suddenly. And it was like, you know, I changed agents fairly recently, and, you know, suddenly she was getting me, you know, three or four meetings a day, sort of thing. You know,
work breeds work, doesn't it? And funny, you said we'd mentioned Drop the Dead Dog. Yeah, we actually mentioned it in our emailing, because I remember very fondly, it's only in one episode part, this photocopy fixer who they turn to for advice.
That's right. You're the man in the street.
Yeah, it's a terrific part.
Yeah, it was a lovely part.
So how had your and they obviously like you an awful lot. So how had you?
Andy gets me in to play the sort of common man who speaks a bit of sense, and I've done quite a few things like that for him. Even in Ballot Monkeys, you know, most recently, but, you know, the guy I was playing was very much the old Labour, sort of straight down the line, John Prescott type, you know. And what happened on Donkey was that, you know, again, it was a straight offer. I didn't have to meet, you know, what is lovely is when, you know, Guy and Andy suddenly ring you up and say, do you want to do this? And you go, yeah. And I can't remember which series it was in. It had already been on quite a lot. But it was quite early on, because so Hayden Glynn was still in it and people like that, you know. And you do that thing where you rehearse for, 4 or 5 days. And it's constantly changing. And then the day before we actually recorded it was the day that they handed out the new franchises for television. So it was that day when Thames lost out to Carlton. And so there were some quite important things. So they literally said, don't hang on to all these lines you've learned, because there's going to be a whole mass of new stuff. And they used to have a competition that was started by, what's his name, who played, who went on to do the Irish thing with Devlin Cohen.
Oh, Steve Tompkinson.
Steve Tompkinson. Yeah. They had a competition for the Crown Belter, the biggest laugh of the week. And what really helped me was that most of the episode was about a softball game, and all the men in the office all went off to play the softball game. And so I was left behind in the office with Hayden and Vicky Wicks and people. You know, there are only about three of them. And so all the news that was coming in, so I had this wonderful line about Jeremy Beadle, wasn't it, or something?
Yeah, he said,
I'm glad LWT's kept his franchise. Why is that? He said, well, because... It was something about now the LWT means you've been framed still on the air. Is it you've been
no,
framed?
No, it's Beatles About.
Beatles About. It means Beatles About still on the air, which means there's always a chance that someone will beat him to death with his microphone. You know, and Tompkinson came out rather ruefully and said, you're the first guest who's got the Crown Belt award, you know.
Because I think you talked with... Watch out, Beatles are stiff.
Watch out, Beatles are stiff. Which I think, I have to say, I think that was my own invention. And I think Andy, who's very good about that, and will say, yeah, you know. Andy used to have a habit where he'd give, if you came up with a line, he'd give you a quid. He literally would give you a pound. And what was great also, so, you know, we were rock, it was a bit rock and roll, because, all that stuff was... written on the day, but it prepared it many years later for Ballot Monkeys. You know, where we were.
Same
there was some stuff. There was some stuff that was going that went out that night. That when we went into work in the morning, we didn't know what we were going to be saying. Not all of it, you know, but about 25% of it was written on the day that it went out.
Now we're currently labouring under the. Guidance of a Conservative majority that surprised, I think, everyone at the last election.
Yes.
So, as a man of the left and a creative person, does satire have an effect? Is it possible to influence people beyond just a laugh? Does it have a role, or is it the left congratulating itself that it's doing something, but it actually doesn't do anything at all?
I'm not fully sure is the answer to that. There's no doubt about the fact that it was interesting that Private Eye edition had their best sales figures ever the day after the election. And that happens, you know, you think of Spitting Image and all that. And I think that things like Ballot Monkeys, and what was the other one they had? There was another one, that sort of like another puppet thing, which was a bit like
Spitting Yes, Image. it was the Spitting Image.
Pete Sinclair
light,
was
it?
Sort
yeah.
of, you know, writing for. And I think that it's a good thing. It means, you know, on the other hand, it's awful that you need to get a sort of basically effectively a right-wing government in order to get that. So, you know, does it mean that, you know, when you have a sort of fairly central ground government, that satire dies? And that you need the Donald Trumps and the, you know, people of that world, you know, to get anything going. Certainly, you know, satire flourished under Thatcher and looks like it's going to flourish again under this lot, you know.
Less specifically political, though. What about cultural, in terms of that you've already alluded to the impact that the change in the way that we make television has affected actors generally? Less drama is being made. Yeah. I mean, how do you account for that? And do you think it's all... Quite often when I do these interviews, there is an element of doom and gloom.
Well, there's no doubt. I mean, it has changed. There is... You know, the money aspect of it seems to be the most important. The thing, you know... you get any bunch of actors of a certain age together and they'll moan about the business till the day... You know, and I'm still a great one for that. I will do it. I try and stop myself sometimes. My biggest bugbear is the fact that creative people are no longer making the decisions, particularly in terms of television. In theatre, it's still pretty good. Basically, in theatre, you've got, you know, some good directors and producers who put on shows, and it's their decisions that things get made. In television, that's not the case, particularly in terms of things like casting, and that actually you've now got a situation that's been coming in for years where the marketing people, the scheduling people have as much say in the casting as the director and the producer and the executives and everyone else. And, you know, I know full well that, you know, I was up for something quite big earlier this year. I was saying to my, you're very much in the frame, and it's now gone to the suits. And I know when it goes to the suits that I'm not going to get it, because most of my stuff's been a long time ago. They're all young, and I haven't got, you know, you have to have this profile thing. In other words, if you've been in The Office or The Inbetweeners or one of those things, it doesn't matter how good or bad you are, they're going to want you in their next program. And, you know, a lot of the programs I did weren't successes. Particularly when I was playing more leading characters. You know, I'm fine doing all the, you know, bits like I did in Doctor Who and that sort of stuff. And, you know, I've done Singing Detective, I've done Our Friends in the North, you know, An Ungentlemanly Act, BAFTA winners, Longitude, things like that. Really nice cameos in proper dramas and things like that. But, you know, when I played leading roles or regulars in series, they've not necessarily been successes. I'm thinking of things like Star Cops, which is my first one, which was not a success. It's still a big cult success. And then I went through a whole range of doing sitcoms. I did four or five sitcoms on the trot, none of which did very well. And there's, you know, that somewhere in, you know, the sort of dark depths of the BBC, ITV, whatever it might be, there are people who are, you know, probably got Alan Cumming haircuts and red framed glasses, are saying, oh, everything this man's been in has not been a success, so therefore we don't want him. You know, and I lose out to sort of sexier performers, sexier in the sort of TV ratings thing. So, you know, when I was up for the series earlier in the year, sure enough, I mean, the guy who got it in the end was an ex stand up, right. You know, who had a name for that, and, you know, and that happens a lot, and I get miffed at that it's about that it's not about creative people casting people who they know are good. It's about other things. It's about marketing. Marketing has taken over everything. And that's my biggest regret about what's happened in our business, really.
Well, I know with Star Cops, Chris Boucher felt that the ingredients were all there for a success, and then somewhere along the line, a series of things seemed to go wrong. I mean, Star Cops is rather liked, I think, but it's rather felt that it was something that was a missed opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, were you feeling that at the time?
Sort of. There was a lot of... There was this, you know, when they showed that series of... The Cult of, yeah. And they made no bones about the fact that the producer, Evgeny Gurdjieff and Chris, didn't get on at all. And that was very... You know, that was very... And there were a lot of things where Evgeny... It was like they were... BBC were rather half-heartedly doing it. there were things where they wouldn't spend money on stuff that should have been. It was interesting that there were two directors and there were two teams on it. And when Graham Harper, who got me the part, as a result of the Doctor Who, that's why I was in Star Cops, he suggested me to the producer and blah, 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 got it because of him. But when Graham did, I can't remember, he came in about episode 3 or 4. He changed everything, the look of it, everything. He said, this is all too well lit. There should only be lights from computer screens. You should have posters around your workstations. You should look like lived-in things, you know. So we did all that, and all this was snuck in. And suddenly it started by about the 3rd or 4th episode, but not until then, to look like a proper office where people had lives and, you know, it wasn't overlit and obviously in the BBC studios. And then the first team came back and promptly got rid of all the Pal Kinsey's koala bear posters and things, you know what I mean, were stuck in dustbins. And they had to go around and find them because of continuity. And there was this angle that they weren't really committed. And I think, I seem to think, you know, Gray hated science fiction. And, you know, as we know, sort of got rid of temporarily Doctor Who for a while. And so, you know, we were onto a losing wicket in one sense. And it was, there's still people come, you know, we had some very good writers on it. You know, people like John Colley, you know, who went off to Australia and then wrote an Oscar. He wrote Master and Commander.
Yeah.
And John Colley wrote that. Who, you know, and he wrote an episode, he wrote the garbage episode of Star Cops. And some really good people on it, you know, and people, good actors involved. And David Calder's a terrific actor, you know.
Wonderful actor.
And you know, we were obviously hoping that it would be it would go on to it. But it, as soon as it came out, and the first episode wasn't a good episode. It wasn't right.
And can you remember your reaction when were you aware before it went out, or was it when you watched the first episode that you went, they've got Justin Hayward from the Moody Blues to sing this very strange song?
I know. We got it. There was a whole thing about what it was going to be called. It was called Star Cops as a temporary title, and there was a competition in house as to what the new thing, and we couldn't find anything better than that, really. And then part of me, I didn't completely object to the Justin Hayward thing. It did seem strange when it was, and I remember some people didn't like it. There was a lot of debate about stuff, it's not a bad song, but it, whether it's right for that, I don't know. I think that even if it had been perfectly made, it might not have had much more of a life because of the powers that be were not that pro it. You know, and that there were certain things, like some of the model stuff was very good, you know. But there wasn't, you know, we'd spend a lot of time in rehearsals, actually, making some of the, although we had some fantastic scripts, there were one or two that weren't so good. And there were a couple that we spent a lot of, you know, David particularly would say, you know, we've got to make this work. It's a story. And we'd spend a lot of time in rehearsals making sure that they worked, that stories worked. So we weren't, you know, there was, in, and writers often wouldn't be there. I mean, Chris's stuff was fantastic. And I mean, you know, there was also, we were hit by the strike. Remember that? There was one episode that we started rehearsing that we never got to film because the strike was on. And we shot the last episode in the studio while the strike was going on, or I can't. And one of the main things was Eric Ray Evans got chickenpox, and you know, for he was in his late 30s then, and if you get chickenpox in your 30s, you're really ill.
Yeah,
he looked unbelievable. I'd never seen, you know, a black man with chickenpox, and he looked like he had these great, like an alien, these great black things that were all over him. And he was so ill that the whole, I mean, it's Star Cops mythology that he's in the episode, but most of his lines are reassigned to him. We did it. I mean, I can't remember, was it Chris? Couldn't come in. And so literally, David and I went in a corner and we gave loads of his lines to Linda Newton. And there were scenes where he was there, but he was shot from the back in a spacesuit. I mean, literally, we worked around the fact he's in the episode, but you wouldn't know it. If you know what I mean, you know, and so there was a lot of that went on as well, which doesn't help, you know, when one's thinking of a new series and this, that, and the other. But you know, fortunately, there's still much love. There's still, you know, I still get requests that conventions for StarCop stuff, you know, and someone naturally showed me the other day on Twitter a Lego figure of Colin Beavis. And I was like, I got very excited that I thought Lego was actually coming. He said, well, no, actually, I think he'd adapted it himself. So it wasn't exactly something that Lego has produced, you know.
Well, with Michael Gray, you know, not loving Star Cops, didn't famously, of course, didn't love Doctor Who. So when you were in Doctor Who, it was at first, it was a bit of a pariah within the BBC.
Yeah.
When you came back to it, life couldn't be more different for Doctor Who.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's, you know, with this time round, you're making movies. You had a really good director, Paul Murphy, who was making films. He was, you know, it's like a film set. It's a very, very different operation. And the machine of that comes out of Roth Lock is immense. We had a read-through. And there were something like 130 people at the read-through, of which maybe 50 or 60 were actually automatically to do with the production. And everyone introduced themselves. It took about an hour. And there was I'm so-and-so. There were loads of people from BBC Worldwide. I'm so-and-so from the BBC, from the Doctor Who fanzine. I'm so-and-so from the Doctor Who shop. You know, and it was all these people. And there's this massive, great machine of people with this stuff. And it is now, you know, one of the leading lights of the BBC schedules, you know. And it's wonderful to see, you know. It is great to see the fact that it's being, you know, and Cardiff itself has become a huge, major centre of television. You know, what was great is I got another job. I think I got another job out of it at the read-through because, what's her face? Nikki, one of the producers, was also producing Wizards and Aliens. And I got, you know, got into that as well. When, of course, that's now gone because it was too expensive for a kids' programme. But did very well, and I think he's up for a Welsh BAFTA or something, you know. But that whole Roth Lock is it's extraordinary, the fact that the whole BBC thing has now just gone from London and, you know, Television Centre is no more and all that. But it's now Manchester, you know, and Cardiff very much so. It's amazing to see. It's a really bustling sort of creative thing going on in Cardiff there, you know, with however many productions they've got going there.
So what about you? Are there things that you would still like to do?
I'd love to go to, I mean, I've been close a couple of times. I'd love to go to the States. I'd love to make movies and go to the States, or be in a long-running TV series in the States, and lots of other British actors do that. You know, I spoke not long ago to Andy Lincoln, you know, who I played his... I had this thing, if you play my child on stage and you end up being a star, and there are quite a few people, it's Jude Law, Andy Lincoln, Brendan Coyle, Donald Gleeson, Gemma Arterton to an extent, and one's just happened this, literally in the last couple of weeks, Denise Goff, who's opened in this show at the National called People, Places and Things, and has had the best reviews I've seen for any actor or actress. She played my daughter. And so this is the thing, if you play my child on stage, you end up being a movie star.
Blessed with greatness.
I don't, but, you know, it's, you know, they do. They go on to stuff. So, you know, that's... I'd love to have done more of that. It's getting to the point now where I'm like, you know, I'm 62, I'm still reasonably fit. I mean, I've had a heart attack a few years back, but I'm still okay. But, you know, I'm choosy now about stuff I do. I mean, in terms of television, you have to sort of take what's going. And it is harder. It's harder than it was. And it's harder to break... what happened was, in about, what was it? About 2001, I went to the RSC for the first time for a long time and did 2 years there. It turned out to be 2 years because we did 15 months or so at Stratford. And then one of the shows was Lieutenant Ivanish Moore, which went into the West End. And so I was effectively doing solid theatre, not available for anything else, for 2 years. And that marked the beginning of falling out of people not employing me in television anymore. And so I've been sort of doing, really having to sort of pull myself back into the whole TV world. And it's still that, you know, that was, you know, God, 15 years ago. Mm. And that's still the case. I'm still not, whereas at one point I was on every casting director's sort of list of fat bald blokes, you know, and, you know, if they couldn't get so-and-so, they'd get, you know, they'd eventually get down to me. That's not the case anymore. You're very aware that, you know, you're having to, you know, my age, I have a great new agent, Kirsten, who's really pushing and getting me seen for things as well. You know, whether I get them or not is another matter. But, and I, you know, I've done some nice stuff. I mean, there's a film, I just did a Terence Davis film called A Quiet Passion, which is all about Emily Dickinson, the poet, with Cynthia Nixon's in. I've got a tiny part now, but apparently, by all accounts, it's going to be wonderful. That's, we'll be in Cannes next year and all that. So, yeah, you know, I'm getting stuff. But interestingly, a lot of it is not me going for meetings. It's because of someone has said, oh, he'd be good at that. And I get that. And work breeds work. And it's people who've worked with you before. And it's that more than, you know, because a lot of new people in the business, you know, I haven't got enough recent credits to sort of really get taken on for things, you know. So there we are. But it's, you know, I'm given up yet. It's all hanging in there.
Well, look, you've given me a great deal of your time, so let's go and get something to eat. But before we do that, nobody pays for this. Nobody gets paid for this. So we ask the listeners to donate to a charity. What is your charity,
Shepard? My charity will be Dog's Trust.
Ah, appropriate.
Yeah, Zach looks up and looks very pleased. I also like the Dog Trust rather than Batsy. They have this thing where they never put a healthy dog down.
Right.
Basically, you know, so I think, you know, people always think, oh God, leaving to dogs. But I love dogs. I mean, there's always been a dog in one's life. And I think they're a really worthwhile charity. Yeah.
That's good. And this podcast was originally conceived to celebrate 50 years of Doctor Who, and has gone on since then. So what is your message to the Doctor Who fans out there, Trevor?
My message to the Doctor Who fans out there is hang in there. There's plenty more to come. I don't know what that means anything, but there we are.
Oh, brilliant. Well, Trevor Cooper, thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure.
Great. Hope that was okay for you.
Yeah, fine. It's good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we barely skimmed the surface. I always feel bad.
Thanks to Trevor, who's on Twitter, by the way. He's at Hatman Guna, which is H-A-T-M-A-N, Hatman, like Batman, but with hats. Guna, Hatman Guna. So follow him and all his news. The election we were talking about, by the way, was before the one that we might have had by the time this one is out. And if we haven't had it, it's imminent. We were just talking about the previous one. That's how up to time we are. Trevor's charity is the Dog's Trust, which you can find at www.dogstrust.org.uk. Dogstrust.org.uk. There's a donate page on that. I think by the time you've had this available to you, I will have run 10k, so I might be dead. Assuming I survived, it will have been by the skin of my teeth. And if I have died, I'm definitely worth a couple of quid on my Just Giving page. Just Giving Toby Haydock is to raise money for my partner's charity to give disabled children access to the arts. If you can spare a penny or two, that would be lovely. There's another one of these next time. My thanks to Trevor, as I say, is a splendid fellow. And the dog you could hear in the background is called Zach. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Soon from Big Finish Productions, Doctor Who, The High Price of Parking.
Welcome to our home, Free Parkers. Welcome to the Tribe of the Lost.
3, 2, 1. Still got it.
Free Parking!
Explosion detected in Sector 3, ma'am. I've locked down the area.
Right, I see. Is it them?
My people, we have found our foe! We must head for glory!
I don't like the sound of that.
I don't like the sound of any of it.
Uh-oh!
They're swinging round! The rocket! God! Get out of the way of the rocket!
Did everyone make it out?
I think so.
Those three Parkers tried to kill me. That's going too far.
Get in! Now!
Whoa, don't have to ask me twice!
Please, do not enter that vehicle!
Step
coming, Sunshine!
Stop! Stop now!
The more corpses pile up, the less chance we have of keeping this under our hats. If you can't stop this, I'll find people who can.
This sounds a risky plan.
On a day like today, any plan's a risk. If we want to save lives, it's a risk we've got to take. Tool up! Let's go stop a war!
Big Finish. We love stories.